This is The Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells, and today we are speaking with Brian Nelson. Brian is a technology visionary as well as an entrepreneur himself. Today's discussion is on technologies most of us have heard of, technologies like virtual reality, artificial intelligence, and Bitcoin. The question is, will any of these technologies have a meaningful impact on our lives, or are they just merely passing fads? Join us this morning to hear Brian's views on how our lives, and possibly even our careers, might be dramatically different in just a few short years. Brian Nelson, thank you for joining us on The Bottom Line.
Doug, I appreciate it. Glad to be here.
So let's start with VR, virtual reality. I first met you, my firm, Albion Financial Group, was hosting a client event at the Leonardo right across the campus from where this studio is. And your name came across my desk as somebody that could help us host a virtual reality experience for our clients as part of the event. Talk to us about where virtual reality is today and maybe some of the cool things that we can do now that maybe 12 months ago we couldn't do.
Sure. Yeah. And again, happy to be here. And yes, that event was remarkable. I had a great time, and I appreciate you inviting me to do that event. Virtual reality is touching our lives and will touch our lives more than we can even imagine at this point. So to be very, I guess, quick and succinct, what can we do today that we weren't able to do 12 months ago? Number one, I would say, is social VR. That's where you're at your house, I'm at my house, we put our headsets on, and we can go into a shared space. And in that shared space, we can hold business meetings, we can play games, we can play ping pong, we can roast marshmallows over the fire. So many different ways that we can communicate in a social setting.
So that's possible today, but the average American is not going to get that experience today. What's the average VR experience today for people?
Okay, so that is available to anybody who has a headset. Very accessible. You click a button and you're now into a social experience. So it's not something you have to do on the side. It's not additional special equipment or anything. However, to answer your question, most of the VR experiences today are gaming, some type of, first-person shooter game or, climbing or any of these games where you can do things in a virtual world that you can never do in real life. The other things that you can experience would be 360 videos. So people are using it to explore different parts of the world that maybe they're not going on a trip today, but they want to go see the Eiffel Tower. Well, you can be at the Eiffel Tower and feel like you're there through virtual reality.
So it sounds like I misspoke. The social setting for VR, which is one of my holdbacks on virtual reality, is it takes you from a social setting in today's physical world and then isolates you in this VR world, which is very cool and you want to go back to.
Sure.
But it's not social. So I'm glad to hear that this social aspect of it is available today. Can people, one of the most popular ways to do VR today, just because it's low cost, is literally using your smartphone. There are some devices, we'll talk about this, but can folks do that on low-end virtual reality devices, or is it just for the $3,000 Oculus Rift solutions?
Certainly you can. You can do it on any headset right now. So even the Gear VR that works with Samsung, you can go right into a social space with that type of headset. So you don't need one of the expensive high-end headsets in order to experience social VR.
Where do people go to get that experience?
Yeah, so Altspace is one of the leading organizations or apps, and you can actually get it on your computer as well. So if you don't have a headset, you can go to Altspace on your computer and act as if you are one of the avatars in the space. And then anybody who does have a headset can put their headset on and actually be there, right? So Altspace is probably the leader in social VR experiences.
Okay, nice. And what about on the equipment? You mentioned the Samsung Gear.
Correct. Yep.
Which is a headset that allows people to use a Samsung device. What's your favorite device if you don't have a Samsung, if you've got an iPhone or a non-Samsung?
Yeah, I mean, if you don't have a Samsung, you're limited. there is the Daydream, which is a headset, but it only works with a Google Pixel, the new device.
I'll share one with the audience. Merge VR,
yeah,
out of Austin, Texas, is an awesome device. It's a, you know, you can get these things for $10 at the office supply store. You don't want the $10 one.
Sure.
I have the Merge VR unit myself. It's really nice. It works with any brand of cell phone.
Yep.
And you really can get a pretty decent feel for what virtual reality is with this $50 headset.
Yeah, no, you bet. There's a lot of different headsets that are coming out onto the market that work with any phone. Very accessible, even a Google Cardboard that you can get for
it's amazing.
Couple bucks.
Yeah, yeah. You can build it yourself for free.
That's right.
The instructions are online, but 100%. You will be amazed. You will get the VR experience. Now, once you do that, that will whet your appetite to want to spend $50 for a better headset, but you absolutely can do that.
Yep.
So your job is, part of your job as a technology visionary, is help people understand maybe what new business opportunities, new technologies are going to launch. What's your thoughts on virtual reality? What are going to be some of the big businesses that maybe today don't even exist?
So virtual reality will touch every business. So let me say that first. It will touch every business. It doesn't matter what vertical you're in. So that's number one. Number two is, if you're an entrepreneur or you're somebody who wants to do something on their own, I always say, what do you like to do? What are you good at? And then just layer virtual reality on top, and boom, you have your idea. You have something you can run with. And we're so early in the virtual reality space that you can own that space moving forward. So all of a sudden you become kind of the guru in whatever that space is, and it doesn't matter what it is. If you're a business owner, you will be impacted by virtual reality. I just got done taking virtual reality to the Abundance 360 conference, which is the conference of Peter Diamandis, where we talk about exponential technologies and how they're impacting the world. And a good third of that conference was all about augmented reality and virtual reality and how they're impacting every single industry. I could go on for days on use cases with surgeons learning how to do surgery in a virtual world. And you think, well, how is that going to work? Well, guess what? There's people that are creating haptic gloves that allow you to feel virtual objects, where you can pick up a scalpel in virtual reality and actually use it and get the feedback from your haptic gloves as if you're touching a scalpel and a body, and it will actually react to what you're doing in this space.
So let me give you a couple examples just so we can explore ways that maybe people aren't thinking about now. You know, real common business is maybe a distribution business or a manufacturing business. How can VR help those industries?
Yeah, so a couple different things. One is, if you take a 3D model of what you are manufacturing, you can actually create that in virtual reality so that you can share that with potential clients, customers, where they can experience your product before you actually manufacture it, number one. Number two, if you are like a retail store and you're selling a product, there are many stores that are now creating the equivalent of an online store for virtual reality. So you walk into this virtual store and you're actually in a virtual reality experience that is a store that your customers can go feel like they're actually there, walking through and purchasing things off the shelf.
If you're just joining us this morning, our guest today is Brian Nelson. He's a technology futurist. He's also the owner of Experiential VR, which we'll talk about a little bit more later in the show. So we're talking about businesses that can be helped. That makes a lot of sense, making it more efficient to go through the existing sales process. What about businesses that might be hurt?
Yeah, you know, there's going to be a bridge from where we are today to where we're headed in the future with a lot of these technologies. And, you know, virtual reality specifically, think about the travel industry. So again, if you can go anywhere in the world and feel like you're there, and for those of you that have not tried virtual reality, this may not make much sense, but if you actually put on one of the headsets, and one of the high-end headsets like an HTC Vive, you'll understand very quickly that you can have experiences that feel real. I have dreamt about virtual reality experiences as if they really happened, and I still have memories, and so they're lasting memories as if I was in this space previously.
It's addictive.
It can be addictive.
You do have to be careful because it's a world that offers you more control than we have in the real world, and there's a lot to be said for that virtual world, but you have to be careful because a little bit goes a long way.
You do have to be careful, and Kevin Kelly, the founder of Wired Magazine, on an earlier podcast said that the biggest companies in the world in the next 5 years will be virtual reality companies, and the reason being is you can get data in the virtual reality system that you can't get anywhere else, like emotion. How do you actually feel about an experience? How do you actually feel about a product? Because you can read eye dilation, you can read breathing, you can read movement.
Normally, we wouldn't let technology read that for us, but for virtual reality, you're wearing something that's inches from your eyes.
It's
so
be natural.
Simple for them to do it, and it will enhance the experience for you. So I suspect people will consent to that.
That's right. That's right.
What about timing? You know, there's been a lot of really interesting technologies that have come out. I think it's Bill Gates that's famous for saying that people dramatically overestimate how the world's going to be different in 5 years, but they dramatically underestimate how different their world's going to be in 20 years. Normally, technologies take a long, long time to play out. You seem pretty convinced that we're on the cusp of a very major change in the way we live our lives. Why do you think the timing's that soon?
Two reasons. One is the convergence of technologies, the way that they are actually converging. We can go into more detail on that. But the second is the idea that things are getting cheaper and faster at the same time, right? So we have Moore's Law. And so we're actually getting to this point, this tipping point of what used to take 10 years to do and the growth of technology and the speed and the size of these technological innovations shrinking are now taking months, sometimes a year to go from V1 to V2, which, a decade ago would take 10 years to get there. So as we see things speed up the way they are, there's this massive convergence. So AI is finally coming on board with some machine learning, and then we have virtual reality, and then we have things like Bitcoin and blockchain. Well, when you tie all of those things together and you say, wow, right? All of a sudden they converge at the same time. I mean, all of these technologies are really at a tipping point at the exact same time. So what happens when we just barely go over that tipping point? That's where we're at
that's,
now.
That's where you live. That's the world you try to live in.
That's right.
So what do you think? 18 months from now, 24 months from now, is there a publicly held company that got there because of virtual reality that maybe doesn't even exist today?
You bet. I believe that to be true. And I also believe that, and I know we're not going here yet, but with blockchain, we're going to see some companies that are decentralized autonomous organizations that are huge organizations that are decentralized in a way that there are no owners per se. It's an autonomous organization that's run by consensus of
we are going to go there in a minute, but I want to stay on this theme of decentralized just for a second because it's a key part of the blockchain.
Yep.
We don't think about it because it's our daily lives and we're used to it, but so much of society and business is intermediaries that maybe don't exist. If there was a way to ensure that exchange with trust without needing a third-party service, I would argue in many ways that's what your bank is.
Mm-hmm.
It's a trusted intermediary between two parties that says, yes, this money went from point A to point B, and it can't be copied and duplicated. So we're gonna go back to that. But the idea of decentralized and looking at our industries differently, and it's just natural to not think of it this way because we're brought up with these industries in place. Go ahead.
And they come in so slowly. It's a gradual thing that we're seeing happen.
Well, Bitcoin's what, 8 years old now?
Yeah, I mean, it came out in 2009. The white paper came out in 2009, and then we saw the actual code come out. But even beyond that, we really look at the ideologies have been shifting. So we're seeing the sharing economy. We're seeing distributed workforces, right? So all of that is feeding into this, all, you know, this distributed, decentralized future. And we've slowly been moving that way. And it's just starting to really turn up as we get, you know, the Ubers and Airbnbs and others that are bringing a decentralized nature to what we're doing.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more with Brian Nelson, who is a technology futurist. He's also the owner of Experiential VR. Welcome back to The Bottom Line on KCPW. I'm Doug Wells. Today we're speaking with Brian Nelson. Brian is a technology futurist, and he's also the owner of Experiential VR. You know, we were talking about before break the sharing economy, the Ubers, the Airbnbs of the world. And I think one of the reasons they were able to get their traction as quickly as they did. Now, it was a long journey for both of those companies till they really started to ramp aggressively. But it may have been impossible for that to happen, certainly in Uber's case, less so for Airbnb, but I argue still the same, which is we all have these supercomputers in our pocket mm-hmm. that not only are supercomputers, but they have a really high-quality camera and a GPS. And I think it's one of the reasons virtual reality has kind of taken off as quickly. The smartphone was never designed to be a viewing device in a virtual reality headset. But it's amazing. It had all of the hardware necessary. When you turn your head, your phone has gyroscopes that know you're turning your head and you're looking down or you're looking up.
That's right.
And it works really, really well. What do you think? Could we be where we're at today if our smartphones didn't have that technology already in them?
No, you're exactly right. I mean, it really smartphones is what is kicking off a lot of these disruptive technologies and disruptive business ideas, 100%. So at XTech Ventures, that's another organization that I have, XTech Ventures. That's a lot of what we look into is what are the trends here? What's happening and what are the resources necessary for those entrepreneurs and business owners that want to take advantage of these new business models and ideas and technologies. And so I agree 100% with you that if we didn't have smartphones that worked the way they do, virtual reality would not be here yet. You know, virtual reality tried to make inroads into our everyday life multiple times over the past few decades. The problem was the hardware wasn't there and the cost was too high. Now with the phones, like you mentioned, that's why we're seeing such a quick adoption of virtual reality. I mean, if you think about it, a lot of these headsets launched less than a year ago, and we're seeing billions of dollars invested into virtual reality.
I think
companies.
12 months from now, it'll be unusual for a household not to have one virtual reality headset. I mean, why would you not? It's $50.
That's right.
So I think some folks are thinking, well, this virtual reality experience is difficult to get and it might be expensive, just on the software side, on the experiences side.
Yeah.
But there's some really good content out there. Not surprisingly, good for Google for mm-hmm. leading the way, but not surprisingly, one of the best sources of free content is YouTube. Talk to our audience about some good resources. So you've got the headset, you've got a smartphone already. But where do you go and how do you use it? You know, what are some good first places to go?
Yeah, so if you have the phone, you'll automatically have within your app, basically an app store. So if it's a Samsung, once you click your phone into your headset, it automatically launches the Samsung store for VR content.
I'm sure it does, but what about if you don't want to pay Samsung for a VR experience?
Right. Well, in that case, YouTube
can they still
is,
go
is,
to? So I've got an iPhone, so
sure.
I'm not familiar on the Android side.
Yep.
Can you still go to YouTube and get the free 360 content?
Mm-hmm. Yes, 100%. So a lot A lot of people are now doing 360 videos, as you mentioned, on YouTube, and some of them are doing it in a way and rendering it in a way that it's also VR compatible. And so you'll see a little button that looks like a little headset, and all you have to do is click on that little button, and it automatically pops up on your phone as a VR experience, and you can just, you know, clip it into whatever headset you have, and now you're there. So
do you have a couple specifics on YouTube, some experiences that you think the average person would enjoy seeing? I'm kind of putting you on the spot. We didn't warn you I'd be asking you that.
No problem at all. I would say that I own most of the headsets available on the market, and because of that, I'm spoiled with the experiences I get. And that's just a roundabout way to say I haven't explored a lot that's on YouTube.
So let me, I'll give you the frugal corner.
Yeah, okay,
side
hit me.
Of this. So sure. If you go to YouTube and you look at their 360 videos,
yep.
You can go bungee jumping, which mm-hmm. is awesome. You can go tightrope walking between two cliff edges somewhere in Utah. It's somewhere down the Red Rock region.
Yeah.
You can look down and you'll actually kind of feel queasy and lose your balance. You can go bungee jumping. I like musicals. You can see Lion King in a virtual from the audience, from the actor's standpoint. So you can actually look around at quote unquote your fellow actors.
Right.
Disney put this on YouTube 360 for free, so it is really incredible.
Well, so even Fox Sports with the Super Bowl, Fox Sports has a Fox Sports VR app, and all you had to do was download the app, and then you had VR right there, and so they would run highlights through virtual reality from any phone, so you didn't need to go to YouTube and you didn't need to go anywhere else. It was just an app that you downloaded right on your phone, and so my kids and I, you know, we busted out our iPod Touches and our phones, and we all downloaded the app, and we had multiple headsets, and so anytime something really cool happened in the game, we'd all put our headsets on and then go watch it in VR. I mean,
well, let's talk about the amazing social impact of that. So
yeah,
I mean, you can see where that would have a negative social consequence. I mean, this is what dad does for a living, right? This is sure. what his passion is. So your family's a little different, but what about for the average family? How do we make this so it helps create stronger families as opposed to more isolation in a world that seems like it's becoming more isolated on its own already?
Yeah, you know, experiences like that are very individual. So to your point, it does isolate you a bit. I tried to watch March Madness last year in virtual reality. That was one of the very first kind of live streaming. It wasn't the highlights. It was live streaming the game in VR. My family's sitting there watching it, and I'm sitting on the couch with my headset on because I get front row seats, right? And so I get to actually experience it. But after a little while, I took the headset off because I was by myself. They couldn't see what I was seeing. They couldn't talk with me on what was happening. So there are some possible negative consequences that can come with virtual reality and taking yourself out of the current situation. What I'll say is, long term, I think social VR is going to play a huge role in actually augmenting social experiences so that when you can't be with other human beings in the same room for a specific reason, social VR will allow you to have that feeling like you are with other people. So it will be a benefit. However, there are going to be experiences where people are just by themselves in virtual reality. No different, however, than if a kid is sitting in his bedroom playing Xbox by himself. It's no different in my view. Now, if you look at...
It's another screen.
It's another
just like,
screen.
Like we've all learned, we have to control our screen time. You know, it's funny because I grew up in an era where, you know, television had just come out. That was the new technology. I was maybe 7 years old when my family had a television. We would go over our neighbor's houses that all had televisions.
Sure.
So the audience is finding out where my frugality comes from. I am not first generation frugal. I am second or third. But in some ways, society was struggling with that. Gee, now instead of sitting around the dinner table talking to one another at dinner, we're watching television. Now, as a parent myself, I long for the time where part of family time each evening was spending an hour watching a show together. And there was no way to record shows. The family had to, and there was only one television in the house. You all had to agree on what's the show we're going to watch for the next half hour. And in a bizarre way, that was a lot more social than I ever realized. Now our television is off almost every day of the week. It doesn't mean we're not watching things, but we're watching them on our own individual screens. And I think that's something that we as a society still need to get in front of. The technology moves so quickly that we somehow have to get in front of that. But I'm hopeful we can. And it's one of the reasons I really like augmented reality. So let's transition to augmented reality, which is inputting this technology on your existing world. First, briefly describe for our audience, what is augmented reality and how is it different than virtual reality?
Yeah, definitely. So when I ask people if they've done augmented reality previously, a lot of people say yes. And then I say, oh, what headset did you use? And they say, oh, no headset. I just used my device like Pokemon Go, right? What they don't realize is that's kind of it's not technically augmented reality. Okay, so yes, you can have a Pokemon pop up and you can see through your phone, you know, what's in real life and then have a little character that's on there. And there's some really good educational books and things like that for children that have that capability. But what you're talking about is a head-mounted display that really allows you to see and hear everything around you, but then overlay holograms on top of your current surroundings, situation.
There is a difference, and you're making a point of making sure we understand the difference. Why is it important we understand the difference between those two technologies?
So number one is because when you're looking at your phone, you're still seeing a 2D screen. And we're not all going to be walking around holding our iPods up and our iPads and our phones so that we can see things that are augmented into our reality, right? We're not gonna use our devices that way. However, when you put a headset on and it just naturally happens, and these holograms are actually 3D and you can walk around them and interact with them, that's what's going to actually happen. There's going to come a day where we all just have some type of glasses on so that when we are walking, we will be able to see additional information that is necessary for us that can help augment our reality in a way that is beneficial to us.
So now, you see looking at your screen really as a very tiny baby step, where you see true augmented reality as a giant leap and a game changer.
That's right. So there's two headsets that are kind of leading the way. There's the Meta 2, and then there's the Microsoft HoloLens. And the Microsoft HoloLens is really the leader right now. And there's so many cool applications with the Microsoft HoloLens.
Well, and if you want to see some of those, Microsoft did their annual technology conference a couple months ago. Yep. And they showed some of the applications for the HoloLens. And one was for a manufacturer of household goods. I don't know, did you see the keynote that they gave on this?
I did, yeah.
And you can actually see the furniture, you can see the goods in your house, in your setting, in that color, and it looks real.
Oh, yeah. It does such an amazing job, because what you do is you scan your perimeter, right? So you scan everything that's in your room. So if there's a couch there, when you're looking at it before you launch the app, it scans your surroundings. It knows where things are. And then within the app, maybe you're looking for a couch. When you grab the couch, you literally pinch is what they call it. You'll pinch the couch in the headset, so you're basically grabbing this hologram and you move it right to where your real couch is and you set it down right there, and it just perfectly overlays, and so you don't even see your old couch sitting there. You just see this new one that you put there. It's remarkable, the technology behind it. I met the creator, Alex Kipman, of the HoloLens last week at the Abundance 360 conference, and just the things he was talking about and the use cases and what they're creating in-house, just mind-boggling.
What are you most excited about for augmented reality? So, you know, the house thing is nice. It really doesn't change our lives. What's going to change our lives?
I think the ability to have transparency in information. So when I walk just down the street and I want to know something about my surroundings or about you know, something that happened here previously, we're going to be able to have that knowledge on hand right this second, ready to go. So you may just be walking through a city and you're there on vacation. Well, all of a sudden you can have all of these kind of pings come up that show you, hey, there's something here that may be interesting to you. You can say, ooh, I want to see what that is. You click on it, and all of a sudden you see maybe a World War II experience that happened in that area as if you're standing there watching it actually happen. So I think just the educational piece to it that will allow us to be more knowledgeable about our past and our future is exciting to me.
It's amazing how, I mean, really what we're describing is, and it's I'm vastly overstating, and it will be more enhanced than this, but all that information is on our phone now, but it's in our back pocket, and it's not just instantly there. And it's amazing when you bring that technology into your existing world, which is what I hear you saying.
Oh yeah, and the ability to also live stream it and share it. So it has a forward-facing camera. So those that I want to share this experience with, they'll see what I'm seeing, but through my lenses. So they'll actually see the holograms just as I do, as well as the world around me. So think about how much we share videos and pictures and all of these things now. Imagine a world where you can share your holographic world on top of your real world in real time through this live streaming.
You know, it wasn't too long ago that I would have said the world's sharing too much. Right? There's just all this stuff that, you know, what you ate for breakfast this morning, you know, I hate to break it to you, most of your friends don't care.
Yep.
But the power of sharing is in the group voting of what sharing experiences are worthy. Mm-hmm. Just in the last year, my television and screen time has switched from me seeking out content, I still do a fair amount of that, to seeing what does America, what does the world think was relevant today, and watching some of that. And it is amazing the new experiences you get introduced to because of the power of some very simple upvoting or liking. It's really a game changer.
And much of it is very personalized to you.
That's what's really scary. We're going to talk about how they do that through artificial intelligence and machine learning a little bit later. If you're just joining us today, our guest is Brian Nelson. As you can tell, he is a technology futurist. He's also the owner of Experiential VR. So before we leave augmented reality, there's a very famous case where a company tried very hard to come out with augmented reality and society pushed back hard. Google Glasses.
Yep.
Why did that not work, and why is it different now?
My opinion. Okay, my opinion is it wasn't really augmented reality as much as it was just another 2D screen that is mounted on your head, right? You're still searching for things. You're still looking for things. The technology wasn't there to do what you can do now. So the Microsoft HoloLens, it is a self-contained computer on your head, not plugged in, running Windows 10 on the cloud. The battery and everything is in the headset. And so it allows you to do a lot. Google Glass was just a heads-up display, right? It wasn't compelling enough to get too many people excited. It was just another way to look at a 2D screen is essentially what it was.
It is incredibly difficult to get it right.
Yeah. Oh.
And once you've seen it right, it's obvious what it is.
Yeah. But
figuring out what society's going to embrace. You know, Utah was lucky enough. Salt Lake was lucky enough. A couple months ago, Tim Cook, famously the CEO of Apple Computers, yep, was in town. Utah Tech Conference hosted him. It's a great annual conference. They always have big name speakers. They had Jeff Bezos 1 year. So just in general for the audience, you should go. One of the questions to Tim that was asked was, what technologies are you most excited about? And I was really surprised that he actually gave a candid answer. Usually they don't answer questions like that. But the technology that Tim said he was so interested in is augmented reality. Does it surprise you that they're more interested in augment? And he specifically said he doesn't see virtual reality being a space that Apple would pursue. Of course, he didn't rule it out.
Sure.
Does that surprise you that he liked augmented reality as a business opportunity better than virtual reality?
No, because if you can do augmented reality correctly, it just takes blacking out the screen to make it virtual reality. Does that make sense? So virtual reality right now is something that can be done, and people are willing to be tethered to a computer for it or to their phone, where it will have its use case long term. Virtual reality just will have that use case. It will fit for a lot of businesses, for a lot of gamers, for a lot of people who want to travel, you know, the world through virtual reality. It will have its place. But augmented reality is the harder thing to pull off. Augmented reality is something that can touch everybody's life in a wearable device that doesn't take you outside of your surroundings. And so the usability of augmented reality versus virtual reality is you know, a tenfold. So I agree with him that augmented reality will have a longer lasting impact on day-to-day life. But virtual reality won't go away. It won't diminish the value of virtual reality in many use cases. But yes, it is augmented reality that will be that long-lasting day-to-day impact.
Well, I hope you're right, because I got to tell you, I'm excited about both, but I'm personally much more excited about augmented reality.
Sure.
And I think it's going to take a company like Apple to whatever that device is to get into the hands of enough people that it really starts to move the needle, because the smartphone's not going to be a fix, as you pointed out and took the time at the beginning of our discussion on this. The smartphone is likely not an enabling technology for it. Maybe it borrows some of the compute power like the Apple Watch does right now.
We won't need phones. It'll all be head-mounted displays that we're using. It'll all be headset-based.
So there'll be no more running back to the restaurant because you left
your
phone there.
You might leave your glasses and have to go back for them,
but
right?
That's like leaving your winter coat somewhere,
exactly.
Right? I mean, once you've experienced the augmented reality world, it's going to be like going outside without a winter coat. You're going to be like, oh, my goodness, I left my glasses.
Yep.
So let's switch gears. Let's talk now about Bitcoin,
okay?
Which is what most people have heard of. The technology behind Bitcoin is this technology called, or this algorithm, or this protocol is really the word I was looking for, this protocol called blockchain. So let's actually start there.
Sure.
What is blockchain, and why is it important, and why does it enable things like Bitcoin?
Yeah, so blockchain technology. Most people have heard of Bitcoin, like you mentioned. But if you think about it, Bitcoin was just the first application built on top of blockchain technology. And so blockchain technology allows for a decentralized, transparent network and ledger. So let me explain it to you this way. So with Bitcoin, I send you a Bitcoin. There's two public addresses that are involved in that transaction, and there's a value that was sent. That transaction is posted as a transaction in a block of transactions. So one block is 10,000 transactions. So from the very first Bitcoin transaction that ever happened, once there was 10,000 of those transactions, it created the Genesis block, the very first block of 10,000 transactions ever. So now, every time 10,000 transactions are made, that block gets added to the blockchain. What that allows is it allows basically this genealogy, let's call it, of every transaction that's ever happened on the Bitcoin network. And that's how these miners, the individuals that are securing the network and that are confirming transactions, are able to do so. And that's why it's so secure. So the longer the blockchain, the more secure the whole network is. And so that's blockchain technology, is allowing for this whole genealogy of every transaction that's ever happened to be in one place. And now, because it's open source, that allows any technologist to go look at the code and see that it's right and see that there's no back doors. And that's what allows for this trusted network and a trustless system. That's why we can trust it, is because once it's locked into the blockchain, is nearly impossible to go back and change a transaction that's happened. Because if you try to change a transaction that was done in block 20,500 and there's 60,000 blocks total, you can't just change that one block, because it will change everything moving up the blockchain, and it's just not going to happen. You're not going to be able to make that change.
That's actually a really strong explanation. I literally have spent hours trying to understand the technology behind it, and eventually I got there.
Sure.
But that's as good of an explanation as I heard. I want to kind of highlight a couple of things you said, one of which is it's a chain.
Yep.
So every new transaction builds on the old transactions. The old transactions and all the codes, and this is code, not necessarily computer code, but it's alphanumeric code, a 30 chain, numbers and letters, and capital is different than lowercase. But all of these transactions are captured in this alphanumeric code, so the next transaction builds on the previous one. And if you change any of the early ones, it actually changes that alphanumeric code throughout the chain post that transaction, which is what makes it easy to detect. And what keeps everybody honest is it's decentralized, so everybody that has Bitcoin has a piece of this code for the whole system. And so you can look at the new transaction and does it say, does everything that came before this agree with the thousands of other people that are storing this information? So go ahead.
If you don't mind, I'm just going to...
I'm sure I've missed this.
Let me just correct one quick comment. So it's not anybody who owns Bitcoin or holding Bitcoin. It's any of the miners that are running the Bitcoin algorithm. So if you're actually running a full node, is what it's called, on the network,
you need all the previous transactions
exactly.
to mine today.
That's right. And so doing that... Yes, there are still tens of thousands of these nodes that all have to agree that this transaction doesn't break anything that happened prior on the blockchain. But I just wanted to make that distinction between those who actually are supporting and securing the network through mining versus just Bitcoin owners. So
okay, thank you. Yeah. And frankly, that's a misunderstanding that I had, so I appreciate that. So we mentioned earlier, we called Bitcoin a cryptocurrency.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the appeals and one of the dangers of Bitcoin is people can pass money anonymously between folks. But you also mentioned that, and we talked about how the transaction is captured, and I believe you used the term public addresses.
Mm-hmm.
So how can it be crypto, but yet we're capturing public addresses?
So the transaction is cryptographically secure, which is fine. That's why it's a cryptocurrency, is because that's how we secure the
network.
Has
to do with the hash tables,
exactly,
the way hash tables
hash table,
work.
That's right. You know, without getting too technical, yes. However, it's not anonymous in the way that you would think anonymity works, right? Because on the blockchain, it's 100% transparent. And so what happened, here's a good example.
Do they know that Doug Wells or Brian did a transaction? And if so, I've heard that it's being used in the criminal underground. And I would think that would be a bad thing about a currency they'd want to use.
You bet. So let me give you one example that will kind of make my point hopefully somewhat clear. Silk Road was a black market where drugs and guns and other things were sold, and they only took Bitcoin. And in those days, they thought Bitcoin is 100% anonymous, and that's why you can do it and you can get away with it, and nobody was worried about it. What happened was the feds were able to figure out who it was that was running Silk Road. Okay. Once they figured that out from just, you know, kind of traditional methods, trying to find who this person was, they had insiders go in and buy and sell things and connect via, you know, email and things like that. Once they kind of gained access, they were able to mine the data that was on the blockchain. that tied real life identities to Bitcoin addresses.
Because so not just that one individual, but they could then figure out other identities.
Hundreds and hundreds of people went down after that. The reason is, if you stick to only Bitcoin and you don't make any mistakes at all, and what I mean by mistakes is sending Bitcoin to an individual where you know that person in real life, and they then take that Bitcoin and they cash it out for U.S. dollars using
like
one of the
exchanges.
For instance,
here locally, people can buy goods on Overstock.com with Bitcoin. So that would be something that now their identity and their address is known. And it sounds like the authorities can use that to go back and trace who it is.
Exactly.
Which I'm glad. I mean,
oh, yeah.
we should have accountability for it.
Right.
So that's the blockchain.
Yep.
Now, how did Bitcoin come to be? I mean, normally currencies can only be created by governments.
Sure.
So how did Bitcoin come out of the blockchain?
Yeah, so in the early days, everybody only talked about Bitcoin. And then it came out that, okay, Bitcoin is actually a digital currency or cryptocurrency. It's a payment mechanism, so it's kind of a payment rails because you can send a currency anywhere in the world without any intermediary. And it's also a technology, which is the blockchain. And so it wasn't until recently, semi-recently, that people started separating blockchain from Bitcoin. In the early days, it was just all one thing. So how it came about was there was a group of cypherpunks is what they were called. And it was a tight-knit group that cared about cryptography and things of that nature. And so Satoshi Nakamoto, we don't know if it's a person or a group of people and a government, whoever
created
Bitcoin.
We won't go into that conspiracy theory. Right. There are some thoughts there, but that's
sure.
A tangent.
Yeah, yep. But so just using that name, Satoshi Nakamoto released a white paper to this specific group and said, you know what, we should really have this digital currency that allows for individuals to be their own bank, to take control, to be empowered over their own finances. And it could have been due to 2008 and the issues that were happening in 2008. And so with quantitative easing and things like that, it's possible that they were just sick of seeing what was happening with the U.S. dollar and decided, okay, there's too many intermediaries, there's too many hands in the cookie jar, so we need to make this a decentralized system, and here's a way that we could possibly do it. Let's test it. Who wants to play? And you got some very intelligent technologists jump in and say, ooh, this code is rock solid. I like this idea. We're all about personal empowerment. And it kind of started off as almost an anarchist type of group saying, yeah, we want to take control of our own lives, not control of the world, but of ourselves. You know, we want to get outside the grid. So the early days, there's infighting with those who wanted to take control for themselves and others that were saying, oh, this is really cool, this is super useful in the world, but we need to do it the right way and comply with all of the compliance and legal and go through that process. So at the very first Bitcoin conference, I saw multiple skirmishes that could have ended in fistfights between those two groups. Now we're seeing that first group has kind of gone silent, and they may be
the
using
anarchy it, the, group.
Exactly. They may be using different digital currencies because Bitcoin is just one of hundreds.
Now. It was actually a big problem. The problem of taking out the trusted third party to control the ledger.
Yes.
I forget, it's got a very famous algorithm. It's a famous challenge that did not have a solution until the blockchain came out.
Right. Yep. Yeah.
But now you can use that blockchain technology and anybody could come up with their currency. There could be the Brian currency tomorrow.
100%, yeah.
As long as people are willing to give it value.
And yes.
That's really been the secret for Bitcoin is society says, okay, we are going to give it value. We talked about, you know, blockchain possibly coming out of the 2008 financial crisis. I've heard a lot of people talking about, well, gee, I think there's going to be runaway inflation, and I don't trust the government, I don't trust the Federal Reserve. Let me caution folks, because this is kind of a field I work in. If you don't trust the government and the Federal Reserve, and there are definitely things that have happened that you could say, gee, I wish that it hadn't gone that way. But the whole cryptocurrency world, I mean, it's a world of very bright computer scientists, and there are ways to hack things. There have been very famous raids of Bitcoin vaults where people have lost tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars in value that have yet to be solved. So just be careful. You're not necessarily replacing one imperfect party with a perfect party. I would argue you're replacing one imperfect party that at least you know, the U.S. government, with another imperfect party that has some flaws, that some of which we know and some of which we don't.
Yeah, so I guess I'll comment quickly on
the vault and the stolen bitcoins.
Yeah.
So, am I correct there? That tends a lot of money. It was a pretty large organization, wasn't it?
Yeah. So let's separate something real quickly. There's Bitcoin, which is the algorithm and how Bitcoin actually functions and works, and then there's organizations that are created to support the Bitcoin network.
Where you keep Bitcoin, those bitcoins.
Bitcoin has never been hacked. Nobody's hacked Bitcoin, the protocol, and how it works. Those that have been hacked have been service providers that are serving Bitcoiners.
The wallets.
Now, not every wallet is provided by a third party. So, for instance, I can host my own wallet that has no third party that can even be hacked to get to. They would have to hack me personally and only me to get to my Bitcoin. However, if I'm holding my Bitcoin in an organization that is a third party kind of service provider, and that service provider gets hacked, it's just like your bank getting hacked. They can get access to your funds. So you can use Bitcoin and be 100% secure in a way that's never been hacked, but it's more difficult. And so what most people do is when they get into Bitcoin, they do the very first thing they do is they open up an account with a third-party service provider, and now they're just trading their bank for a Bitcoin bank because you still have that third party, that intermediary. Great. It's a gateway drug to Bitcoin, right? It's like, hey, get them started on Bitcoin.
Is that how you use Bitcoin, or do you just hold your Bitcoin yourself? And
I have two different ways that I do it. One is very secure for me personally. And then one is, I have an ongoing, wallet with Coinbase. And with Coinbase, I understand the risks. It's the same risks that I would have holding a bank. They even have insurance that insures my account just like a bank does.
That's funny. I didn't know that.
Yeah, you bet. And
it's
so,
not backed by the FDIC, though,
no,
I can guarantee you
no,
that.
No, it's not FDIC, but it is an insurance policy. So, I just wanted to make that clear that Bitcoin has not been hacked. You can do it the right way and protect yourself. But if you're if you just have funds that you're using on a day-to-day basis for small transactions and things, yeah, it's easier to use a Coinbase system, and you know the risks of Coinbase getting hacked or ItBit or any of these other companies. So it's the service providers that have been hacked, not Bitcoin.
Okay. I want to move on, but before we
sure.
do, I want to share with the audience a little bit about how blockchain can be used. I mean, we don't think about it, but you think about the stock market, which I work in on a daily basis, or the bond market, closely related. There has to be a third party there, right? If you own a bond, so Walmart issues bonds, and I like the 2% that Walmart's going to pay, so I own the bond, and I decide to sell it. I sell it to somebody else. Well, how do we ensure that transaction actually took place? And we use custodians, firms like Schwab or Fidelity or TD Ameritrade, Vanguard, the list goes on and on.
Mm-hmm.
But in a world with blockchain, we can ensure that these bonds have moved from party A to party B without that third person. And that is big, big dollars when you start looking at Wall Street. What are some other, just briefly, a couple other uses for blockchain that you see coming in the near future?
Yeah, so there's a lot of companies working on trade finance. There's other companies that are working on like supply chains, where you don't need to get out of your currency because you may have a supply chain that hits 10 different countries. And so how do you balance your books without having to have 10 different transactions with these foreign currency exchange rates and fees and third parties? How can you move money within that supply chain? That's happening right now. decentralized Dropbox. So the idea that you're saving your documents, but you're saving them in a decentralized manner with thousands of nodes that have a tiny little piece of your document, right? And they're actually getting paid. So you right now, Doug, can put up your hard drive, set up an account with Storage, this company called Storage, which is a local company. They moved here from Atlanta just under a year ago now. And you can actually make money by putting a certain amount of your hard disk drive space on the network, on Storage's network. And so what happens is I might pay $5 a month to Storage, the company, and I'm able to save my documents in a decentralized way, which is similar to Dropbox. But guess what? Dropbox and any of these other services are still an organization that can be hacked with single points of failure, potentially. Storage is saying, we have no single point of failure. Your document
is
saved
redundancy. So you have 1,000 people that put some of their excess hardware, their storage capabilities on board, and pieces of, just for the sake of simplicity, 1,000 people. 1/1,000th of your file is stored on each of these, so it becomes much harder to find and assemble that document.
That's right. Yeah. For simplicity's sake, yes, that's exactly how you do it. And they're killing it. They're doing it. I mean, they're really growing rapidly because people are realizing that, wow, I don't need to trust a third party like a Dropbox or one of those others and hope that they don't get hacked and get my documents.
You know, that's the problem, too, with all of this is, you know, are hackers going to go after your personal account or my personal account? Not for the assets. They may come after us individually to get access to databases that or storage that we have access to. But where hackers really want to go is like the Target hack or the Yahoo hack, where there's tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions, of users on board. And, you know, the old system, think about Fort Knox, where the U.S. keeps its gold. Right, you have one secure location with a lot of value. That works in a physical world because you can put a lot of soldiers around that and a lot of safeguard. In the cyber world, you're just asking to be hacked because the treasure trove is so big.
You bet. And what happens, right? These companies, they want to grow. They want their market share to go up. You know, they have shareholders. They need to report to shareholders. So they're trying to get as big as possible. But the bigger they get, the bigger target they become for all these hackers. So now there's this new business model of get as big as you can, and there's nothing valuable that anybody has access to if they hack into you. Wow, now all of a sudden you have this business model where your costs come down, you don't have to worry about loss, you don't have these security issues, and now you can become this gigantic company, and the bigger you get, the more secure you get because you have a bigger distributed network, and so it's the exact opposite of what we've been experiencing for
decades. I can see why this company is getting a lot of traction. I want to transition now to artificial intelligence, but before we go there, something that everybody listening can benefit from today is tangentially related to what we're talking about. What should we be doing with our passwords? I mean, we talk about this. The reality is if anybody finds your the username and the password for your personal email, they can unlock. I don't care how crazy your bank's password is. They all have reset features, and so really your email is your gateway. So how do we lock down our email, and what should we be thinking about for passwords?
Yeah, so a lot of people turn to a company similar to like LastPass, where it holds all of your passwords, and man, that scares me to death. I know a lot of very smart technologists that use companies like that, but talk about like one central point of failure, right? You're trusting all of your passwords to one organization that supposedly secures them. Now, I can't say if they're good or bad or whatnot, so I'm not trying to say don't use LastPass or one of those other systems. For me, you just have to follow kind of the security protocols of changing your passwords every so often and using, you know, words that aren't part of your daily life, things like that. I know of an organization actually based out of Idaho that is implementing a blockchain-based email security mechanism. So when you go to hit send on your email, even if somebody hacks your email and they try to send an email from within, once you hit send, it actually runs this whole identification mechanism on the back end through blockchain technology to say, do you have the private key? Are you the right person that can actually hit send on this account? Yeah, you have access because you got in with a password, but that doesn't mean that when you hit send, it actually does anything.
So that's internally, and I like all the suggestions. Yeah. There's also externally the quickest thing, and most of the people in the audience can do it today, but I bet most of us haven't done it. I've done it. But somebody had to encourage me to do it, so I'm encouraging the audience to do it. Two-factor authentication. You know, make sure, you know, my email's on Gmail and make sure you have that turned on. So if somebody logs onto your account from a computer that you haven't logged onto before, Google's going to send you a text and say, hey, here's a code. So two-factor authentication is something you can do tonight. And I would argue you probably should do it tonight.
100%. I have two-factor on basically everything because it's the easiest way. It's the easiest way to protect yourself.
If you're just joining us this morning, our guest is Brian Nelson. He's a technology futurist. He's also the owner of Experiential VR. We're going to have to wrap up here pretty soon, but I don't want to let you go without talking about artificial intelligence, perhaps the thing that's going to have the biggest impact on not only how we play and how we live our lives, but potentially and very likely, actually, the types of careers humans do versus the type of careers computers do.
Mm-hmm.
So broadly speaking, people have heard of artificial intelligence and machine learning. They're close cousins, but they're different. What's artificial intelligence and what's machine learning?
You know, I don't think you can have artificial intelligence without some level of machine learning. Machine learning is really taking in as much data points as possible and then trying to disseminate outcomes and usable information from the data that comes in. So it can be anything from an individual or how a vehicle reacts in a certain situation, right? So you know, Tesla with self-driving cars or whatnot. They have all these data points that are coming in, and it's being fed to this machine that's taking all of these data points and trying to learn from the data points so that it can then feed back to the vehicle how to react in certain situations. You know, that's kind of machine learning. And with artificial intelligence, you have to have this feedback mechanism that's happening in order to have machines learn to learn. Which is probably somewhat difficult to understand for many people that a machine
take a crack at that. How does a machine learn? I had lots of people. I told you I took an online course on this.
You bet.
And a lot of people have asked me, but how do you explain to people how does a machine learn?
You know, it's there's a couple different pieces to the puzzle. And I think what a lot of people when they think about artificial intelligence, they think about a general intelligence. And what we're seeing right now is we're not really anywhere close to a general intelligence yet. We're still working on very specific artificial intelligent engines. So this artificial intelligent robot, let's say, can do one specific job really, really well. But they can't do anything else. You know, it's like they only do this. And it's because of all of the machine learning that's happening. They start taking that information and saying, okay, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. And as it's doing those things, it realizes that, no, this isn't maybe the best way to do it because it's getting more data points based on what it is doing individually. And so then it kind of learns that, oh, that actually didn't work.
Here's what I tell people simplistically, which is, you know, if you were a Martian and came down to Earth and you were looking at the traffic as people are driving to work or out of work, and you notice all the cars stop, you know, somehow there's a pattern here. They all know to stop. How do they know to stop?
Right.
Well, you'd very quickly be able to recognize when the light's red, everybody stops. When the light's green, the cars go.
Yep.
Right. So that's a pattern.
Yeah.
Now, imagine if there were 100 lights there, though, and there was some combination that would say go or stop, and you could easily do that. Much harder for us as humans. We're good at two or three, you know, really smart people, maybe five or six dimensions, but that's it, where computers don't have that limitation. So they can group things together and find patterns that would be really, really tough for a human to do. So that's simplistically
how
I explain it. Now, you mentioned Tesla. That's a very famous example. It's in the press now. Clearly, computers are better drivers than us. There has been an accident. There's been a fatality with a Tesla where the autopilot was engaged. But even though it's not perfect, the computer is a better driver than you or I.
And it's getting better with every mile that's driven by every Tesla. It's getting better. What happens to individuals as we get older? Our speed of reaction slows down, right? And so arguably, maybe we get worse as time goes on. We get comfortable switching lanes without using a blinker. We get comfortable just eating while we drive, right? So we arguably get worse at a certain point.
That's what my wife tells me. She's never liked my driving, but she likes it less today than she did 10 years
right,
ago.
Right, sure, sure. But with these cars, every mile that's driven is learning. It contributes to additional learning.
Which has a couple impacts, right? One is give me a choice between a better formula, what's called an algorithm in the industry, with a lot of data, or a worse algorithm with a lot of data, or a better algorithm, just a formula, just different formulas, with less data. Data wins every time.
Yeah.
Now, here's what we're not hearing from the government, is this is a monopoly that is taking place. The Googles, the Amazons, the Facebooks, and I'm touching the third rail here. Fortunately, I don't think our show has a big listener audience in Silicon Valley, but here it does. But I think the government needs to get into this now because there's a huge first mover advantage, and he who has the most data wins. What's going to happen to the competitive environment because of that?
Goes back to decentralization for me. Citizens, individuals are slowly realizing that empowerment is really the key. And as they see organizations that are the superpowers, this monopoly of information, there are competitors that are open source platforms that are working on decentralizing artificial intelligence, decentralizing data.
And I think the government has to play a role in that, because I don't think Google and Apple and Facebook are going to willingly open source their data, which is what I think needs to happen.
Although Google already has.
They've open sourced the patterns, the algorithms, but not the data.
That's right. So if we have open source algorithms and we know how they're doing it, now the question is, how do we get the data points if they don't come from Google? My prediction is there will come a time when there is open sharing of data, because individuals will be empowered to basically sign yes or no, I'm going to give this data up. And if they're incentivized through financial awards or something of that nature to give their data up, because right now we give our data up and who wins? Google, because Google then sells that data and they get all the ad revenue. But what happens if there's a competitor that says, actually, when you give your data up, you choose what data to give up and you get specific rewards for the amount of data you give up, who you give it up to, and all of a sudden, individuals are going to be incentivized to use different platforms that benefit them long term, and they feed into a decentralized algorithm that then is running the engine behind AI. And I think that's the only way it's going to win or it's going to work, because if it is siloed, we've got problems.
We've got a big problem, and I suspect it's going to be a big fight.
Yep.
They're not going to give up the data willingly, and it will be the Standard Oils and the AT&Ts of our time with monopolies, and it'll be an ugly fight. So that's one impact, just the huge power that those with the data have and how it builds on itself very rapidly. A six-month lead time is a lifetime in artificial intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
What about for our careers? And we're going to have to wrap up on this question, but I think people are going to be surprised over the next decade the types of jobs that will be able to be replaced by computers.
Number one, I implore every listener to seriously sit down and think about how their career will be impacted by the technologies we've been talking about. Because I guarantee you're going to be impacted by one, if not all of these technologies in the very near future. And if you plan today, you start putting a plan together on how do you move forward. And I work with a lot of individuals on this specific topic. So, okay, you hear about these technologies, you know they're coming. Well, what do you do now? How do you set yourself up now for not only protecting yourself for the future, but taking advantage of these crazy opportunities that are just sitting here right now? So you need to do it. That's super important. Let's talk about artificial intelligence very quickly in this vein of careers. Artificial intelligence is going to take the jobs of individuals that are doing repetitive work. So things that are just fairly easy to do, and even if they're not easy, but they're repetitive, AI is going to take that. Robots are going to take those jobs. You don't need a human to do these repetitive things. AI is also going to take the jobs at the very highest level, where we either can't do it, it's hard to do, it's just cost prohibitive. AI will do that work really, really well. So that leaves all of us in the middle. In the middle between the lower jobs of repetitive work and the very, very educated, hard jobs at the top. So where does that leave us? A lot of jobs will be fine, but I think it's going to come down to creativity. It's going to come down to how do we think dynamically in a way that is creative. I think it's going to be a while before AI thinks creatively. Now, with that being said, there's a local guy here that has written an algorithm that has read all of Shakespeare's work and written its own Shakespearean poem, right? Or play.
And it's not great, but it doesn't suck either.
That's exactly right.
And that's the first iteration.
And that's a first iteration, one guy in his basement just writing an algorithm for fun, and he can do that. So although they're not creative, they can take creative work and create creativity, but they can't. Or I call them they, which is so fun, right? I mean, we're talking as if they are people already. Hello, this is the future is now. So they are being creative because they're being fed creative work. Whereas individuals, we work similarly, right? We are exposed to a lot of different things, and that's what allows us to be creative. But we have a different creative way of being that I think artificial intelligence is a long ways away from. We're all going to be impacted, and that's one of the things I love to do is just help people realize where the opportunities really lie with these technologies, because you might as well take advantage of them.
Great. And that's I like that suggestion that people start thinking about their careers today and what they need to do to prepare for some of these changes, because oftentimes it can take a couple years of effort. And I think we have years, but I don't think we have decades.
We definitely do not.
I think it's in the 2 to 5 years until we start to actually really see the impact.
Yes.
On careers. So, Brian, last question for you. I mentioned in the prefaces to the breaks in the open, you're also a CEO of your own companies, Experiential VR and X-Tech Ventures. Just quickly, what are those?
Yeah, so Experiential VR really is just getting virtual reality into the hands of as many people as possible. So we take VR into corporate events. We take it on the road for clients. If they're going to an expo or a conference where they want to get the attention of the attendees, we'll show up as kind of the event booth attraction.
Why do you do that? What's the motivation for you?
For me, I love showing people VR for the very first time. I mean, when somebody has a headset on and all you can see is their mouth because the headset covers everything else, and you see that smile turn up, it's like, boom, I got them. I got them, right? Because it's one of the only technologies that it takes 2 minutes for somebody, or 2 seconds for somebody to actually get it. And they take the headset off and the wheels are turning. Like, oh my gosh, I can't believe how great this is. Or, whoa, this is crazy. This is going to impact me some way. So I love seeing that feedback. That's one reason. The other reason is we're still really early in VR. So it was a way for me to get into the industry heavily, be connected to a lot of people in the industry, make money in the industry without putting all of my eggs in one basket and try to create something that people
and
may or may
not
like.
You're one of the few people in Salt Lake that gets a tax deduction for buying his VR equipment.
That's
so,
right.
So see, well done. How about your other company? X-Tech Ventures.
X-Tech Ventures is really an organization where I try to help entrepreneurs, business owners understand how to take advantage of these exponential technologies. So X-Tech Ventures is kind of really my baby. So I love to sit down, brainstorm, help companies find what their strategy is, and help individuals find what their personal strategy is. And the website is just xtech.io. So xtech.io.
All right. Well, great. It's been a fascinating conversation. This may have been the longest interview we've done in the 3-year history of The Bottom Line. In part, just you're a fascinating guy working in a fascinating space. Brian, thanks for sharing your story with us today on The Bottom Line.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Our guest this morning has been Brian Nelson. He's a technology futurist. He's also the owner of Experiential VR and XTech Ventures. Today's show was recorded at the KCPW studios on Library Square and produced by Ross Chambliss. You can hear our entire interview with Brian on our website, kcpw.org. And trust me, there's a lot more than you heard on the air. This is The Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells. Join us next week.